For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell in our subterranean dwelling.
Yes.
Discussing all things philosophical, trying to bring everybody to the light of truth. So unfortunately these days, that's a little bit harder than it
seems like.
Yeah, it seems like it's getting more and more difficult to dig through the muck and mire. And, you know, unfortunately, there's some scandals brewing within the church. Mm-hmm. And where there's scandals, there's investigations. And where there's investigations, the question is, who investigates who? So, you know, part of the idea behind this show, Tim, when we started, was to take the headlines, take what's going on out there that everybody else is talking about, everybody else is reporting on, and try to dig underneath it, try to get below it to the ideas and the principles and sort of the philosophical content that people have to understand to be able to come to informed opinions about these things.
Yeah, so it's laying out some first principles maybe, or some foundational principles for us to kind of be able to think through and make sense of kind of what's going on in the contemporary setting. And I think so for today's show, we're going to look at the relationship. At least part of what we're going to do is we're going to begin with looking at the relationship between church and state, which is a very important topic for us. Not only because there's scandal and headlines that are happening, but there's this. It's an important understanding that we want to reach on, how, especially here in the American setting, on how the church and state cooperate, how they have some common ground, common interests, but also how they differ and have different, I would say, spheres of both authority, but also duties and responsibilities.
Right. I mean, that's kind of one of the, you know, using the word genius, that's one of the geniuses of the West to a certain extent.
Oh, I thought you were going to say me.
No, but, no.
Darn it.
Yeah. But, you know, genius in the sense of a specific characteristic that really sets the West apart from other cultures within the world.
Yeah.
And one of them is this separation from church and between church and state that
we've
really had since the advent of Christianity.
Yeah, the separation of church and state. And I think and the preeminent, obviously, modern example is the United States, right? Founded on that. And for a long time, it was thought, and I think for good reason, that a separation of that church and state ought to be. You see it in the Eastern Orthodox, really, for a long time, where should be sort of contiguous. Where you still see it, there's a certain element of it even in Britain, in the sense that the Queen, or if there's a King of England, is also the head of their church, right? And in Eastern Orthodoxy, I'm going to point to the age of the czars and czarinas, that they were the head of the state and head of the church.
Well, I'm not so sure in the case of the czars and czarinas that was quite the case. You always had the patriarchs, and you always had the patriarchates of the churches themselves. They were related to each other. There was a definite relationship, and certainly the tension.
Yeah, head's probably the wrong term for me to use.
Right. Now,
but
England,
they're clearly
England,
the defender,
right. now,
the in, defender
yeah.
of it.
Now,
right.
England, you're quite correct. You know, yeah. England,
that was Henry VIII.
Yeah, Henry VIII, exactly. He declared himself the head. But, you know, England's a little bit of an anomaly there.
Absolutely.
And you know, going back even to Constantine, there's always been this idea that the temporal power of the state and the spiritual power of the church are two separate things, two separate entities represented by really two separate groups of people even.
Yes, but there is a period. Yeah, I agree. And keep me on the factual path, Mark. I believe when we go back and think about the period in which we had the papal states, that was an example of in which you had the Holy Father kind of had two swords, a temporal sword and a spiritual sword. And the spiritual sword was always known to be the far superior one.
Right.
But he carried a temporal sword, I think in part for two reasons. The Holy Father would wield temporal power for one, again, this is going back to, say, you know, the Middle Ages, carried all the way through to, what, like 1880 or something like that. It was thought that the Holy Father would need temporal power, temporal land, one, for just security, right against, because popes had been kidnapped and overrun by armies and things like that. So having land, and land, of course, was the source of, you go back to the economic conditions of the time and commerce, land was the source of one's property and wealth and revenues and things like that. So
it was the means of production.
Yeah, you go. Great way to put it. So there has been periods. So you're right. I think conceptually there's been that important distinction between temporal and spiritual power, and how it's being wielded between the state and Holy Mother Church. But I think, again, going back to the founding of the United States, you probably have the most definitive set of political arrangements in which that's really delineated through both the Constitution and its amendments.
Right, because the United States came about after the Protestant Reformation.
Right.
And so Protestantism really, when you're talking about separation of church and state, then you're adding another dynamic, not only of just temporal power and spiritual power, but temporal power and which spiritual power? So
right, WHICH. Right, that's right. Because it's interesting, right? That's a great point to bring out, because it's interesting to think about that you know, the clear, you know, delineation between church and state in a political setting and reality was driven primarily by this desire for religious freedom, right? The Puritans were feeling persecuted.
Exactly.
And
Presbyterians.
Etc. And so
once again, that character of King Henry VIII.
Yeah. Although I think his motives were a little different. But yeah. I also think that's why, when you look at the plurality of religions, especially Christian denominations, let's say, America is the preeminent example of that, because in America, with this, you know, very clear distinction between and delineation between state and church, America proved in the 19th century and beyond and going forward that it can it's fertile soil for all sorts of new, at least flavors of Christianity to emerge.
Right, and even here, the relationship between church and state has transformed over the years.
Yes.
Some people call it a development. Other people will call it a, you know, definitive, you know,
rupture
and break and change. But you know, when the Establishment Clause was put into the Constitution, the Congress shall pass no law respecting the establishment of a religion, most of the states had an established religion.
Yeah.
And when the Constitution was adopted, it didn't change that. They retained their established religion. So the idea was each state, each city, each municipality within the state, that these were decisions that were left to them.
Yeah, more not, local, not
exactly,
a federal.
Not a federal. There wasn't going to be a national church, but there could still be
a state church.
The Church of Virginia, which was, you know, the Church of England, or, you know, the Church of Massachusetts, which, you know, I'm not even sure what the established religion was in Massachusetts at the time. But nonetheless, there was established religion. So that went by the wayside gradually. And then we've eventually gotten to the standpoint where religion is kind of restricted from the public sphere. So, you know, there's been a change, and some of it for the better, maybe some of it for the worse, depending on how you look at it.
Right. And it was only a few programs ago that we were taking a look at. We were in the middle of Fortnight for Freedom, which has been, what, maybe 8 years now we've had that here in the United States, where we bring up we raise the question about, you know, the question around what does it mean to be a faithful citizen of the United States and a faithful Catholic?
Exactly.
You know, and are those two things compatible. I mean, should be the, you know, what does it mean to be faithful in each of those as a citizen and as a Catholic? And then can we put the two together? And where might there be conflict between those two things?
Right, right. And you know, the conflict comes to the fore, you know, in incidents like what's going on right now with the investigations of scandal within the clergy. So as those investigations go on, the question comes up, you know, what role does the state play in kind of watching over the church? What role does the church have in kind of policing itself? And so all of those questions kind of tend to come bubbling back up to the surface.
Exactly. And that's where I think we go back to, as we're talking about, you know, sort of the spiritual authority and temporal power. It's clear. I mean, it's clear in the setting that in the United, I guess limiting my comments right now to the United States, it's clear that, you know, the United States, the Catholic Church in the United States operates within and is subject to the laws of the state.
Exactly.
So there has to be a kind of compatibility there. But over time, if you go back to someone like even like a Lord Acton is going to point out that having a vibrant religious community is essential to securing the freedoms and rights of the people, because the state, with a capital S, the state tends towards tyranny at times, right? They tend to lots and lots of political systems over time through a kind of hierarchical corruption tends toward tyranny, and it's really this sphere of religiosity that the church, for example, is the one that who calls us to account for the sanctity of life and what it means to be, right? The Constitution doesn't spell out what it means to be authentically human.
Right, right, exactly. And, you know, you bring up abortion, and I think that's a great example of, to a certain extent, the role of the church, particularly in a modern state like America or Western Europe, because we just had the vote in Ireland where, you know,
the
people of Ireland voted to allow abortion. The church,
I'm still not over
right,
that.
and you know, in a lot of ways, you can look at what happened in Ireland as a failure of the church to a certain extent within its spiritual realm of
the pushback against secularism.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Pushback's the wrong word, but
nonetheless, educating and informing consciences so that people, because modern states are more or less run by the people. You know, we are a system of the people, by the people, for
wherever
the people.
You find a sort of a democratic
right, group. Exactly, yeah. And so. That when you're talking about dangers of tyranny in the modern setting, it's really, you know, it's more of a tyranny of the masses, I think, that's probably the bigger threat than necessarily a tyranny of the hierarchy. And I guess that kind of brings political differences to we got one party that thinks that way and the other party that thinks the other way.
Well, it also harkens back to Plato's Republic, right, where he draws out that the flaw in that magnificent work, where we get we've borrowed part of the name for a program from the cave, is that democracies, one of its vulnerabilities and why he rejects it or says it's not the best form of government, is that when you have when you go by popular vote, in other words, or majority vote of things by the masses, that there's this tendency for the masses to vote towards one, to get it wrong, and two, vote towards, you know, selfishness.
Yeah.
At the expense of the aristocracy,
right,
or the landholders.
Yep, and I think the Republic is a fantastic book to look at to kind of guide this discussion a little bit, because what Plato lays out really has kind of what has kind of come to fruition to a certain extent within the Western world. So we're coming up on a break. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, let's talk a little bit about Plato's Republic.
It's not too early to sign up for our Catholic Radio annual dinner. This year's dinner will be on Tuesday, October 2nd at the Northside Knights of Columbus Hall near 71st and Keystone. Archbishop Charles Thompson will be our guest speaker. There'll be a silent auction, a live auction, some great food, and a chance to meet the staff and board members of Catholic Radio Indy. You can sign up right now at catholicradioindy.org or by giving us a call at 317-870-8400.
Hey, buddy, got a match?
Sounds like a line from an old movie, doesn't it? Well, the truth is, you may have a match, one that could benefit Catholic Radio Indy, and you're not even using it. Many area companies have programs whereby they'll match your donation to charitable organizations, but you have to ask. So why not check with the HR department where you work and see? Catholic Radio Indy is a 501c3 organization and may be eligible for a match. It never hurts to ask.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell. And before the break, Tim, we were talking about the relationship between church and state. So a lot of, I think, what's going on in the news right now, bottom line is this tension between the role of the state and the role of the church, the spiritual power and the temporal power, and how they interface, particularly here in the United States. And you brought up Plato's Republic right before the break. And I think what Plato lays out in that book, I think, is a great guideline to talk about the relationship between the church and the state. Because what Plato's talking about is the relationship between philosophical truth, which in Plato's day, there was no institution that was teaching philosophical truth to a certain extent. It was sort of nebulous and out there, and the philosophers were trying to discover it.
And only a very few were teaching and being taught.
Exactly, exactly. Right. And then you had the power of the state, which otherwise was pretty absolute. And so what Plato, he did more than alluded to it. What Plato laid out within the Republic is that the state is answerable to the light of truth. And so we as Christians know that the light of truth is Christ, and that light is then magnified through the church.
Yeah, that you're right. That is, I'm so glad you went there with first in terms of talking about Plato's Republic, because that is the one of the essential questions to get right, which is, who has final authority? Do I, as, say, the king or emperor or president, do I have top authority, final authority, ultimate authority, or am I held to a standard or authority that goes beyond myself?
Right, right.
That's
exactly
the key. Yeah, and to recognize, yeah, when you recognize that,
yep,
that absolute authority is beyond humanity.
Right.
Lies beyond humanity. There's a transcendental truth, as you said, a set of standards, moral code. Then everyone can be held accountable to that standard.
Not only is everybody held accountable, but to a certain extent, everybody has responsibility for maintaining, you know, I guess, the truth within society.
Yeah, and you're right, and even beyond that, I mean, that's sort of minimum. But beyond that, it's to love the truth, right?
Right, exactly.
It's to love the beautiful, to love the good.
Right, and the good and the just, right?
Yes,
to love justice as well, and to make sure that the justice is permeated throughout society. And then
we're not just subject to the will, right? Meaning the desires, you know, of a single person or even group of people that may have some authority over us and helping us pursue the common good.
Right. Now, we talked about separation of church and state, the idea that there is a temporal sphere and there is a spiritual sphere. And yeah, they've mixed and mingled to a certain extent within the history of the West, but they've always been separate concepts. And so the question of this
in Christianity.
Right. So I'm going to throw this out as a very sort of hypothetical hypothesis to discuss. The way this balances out is that because you've got the split between the spiritual and the temporal, You've got accountability on both sides. So you've got the kings and the temporal governments, Congress, presidents, etc., holding the church accountable to justice to a certain extent, and you've got the church holding the state accountable to the light of truth. And so nobody really is above one or the other. There's sort of an equal give and take between the two. I'm going to throw that out. You know, you've got almost a yin and the yang here in the West between the spiritual and the temporal.
Well, I would say I would mostly agree with that. I would say you're right in that there ought to be some mutual accountability and responsibility partnership, collaboration between church and state, to the extent that church and state have a common or shared vision of the good, the true, the beautiful, what are we pursuing together? And there ought to be a lot, and we do see a lot of collaboration and cooperation between church and state. But I think at the end of the day, we're going to say, I think I'm going to say that the church, in her pure doctrinal, dogmatic proclamations, in the truth that she brings, that is superior to what the state has.
Right. Well, the truth is superior. And I would say the truth, to a certain extent, it's magnified by the church. But there's a distinction there. So
yeah.
You've got what the church is teaching. You've got the content of the teaching of the church. And then you've got the institutional church itself. And there's a definite distinction between the two.
Correct. And I would say thinking again a little bit about, scandal and crisis, you can have something. We've seen, say, on the side of the state in America, where America has, I think, very laudable and praiseworthy ideals spelled out in the Declaration of Independence. You can see a lot in much of the Federalist Papers, the constitutions and amendments. And yet we also have seen in that, even though there are these laudable ideals there, that us human beings have failed,
right, exactly.
Often. Well, I think things will continue to improve, but failed to live up to those ideals over time. And I would say that's also been true of the church, because the church here on earth is made up of what? The same sinful human beings. And so the church, even though I think we would acknowledge the light of truth that Holy Mother Church has, is superior, because it's what God has revealed and endowed her with as part of the tradition with the capital T. It's still up to sinful men and women to carry out the project, and therefore there can be failings, even immense tragic failings along the way.
This is Jim Ganley, the kind of temporary caveman here.
Are you the one that's supposed to keep us accountable now?
Well, that's easier said than done. But as you were talking about church and state kind of deciding what's right and wrong, what came to my mind was church, state, individual. What part does the individual have in determining what is right and wrong? Or is it entirely up to the state and entirely up to the church, and the individual
is on their own?
Is on their own, yeah. Well,
that's a great question.
We did a show fairly recently, a few weeks ago, on conscience. And I think that's kind of the key to this whole question, is the church's role, the church's responsibility is to inform the conscience of the individuals that make up the state in whatever form that is. So if it's a monarchy, the church's role is to inform the conscience of the monarch and, on down, so that he can rule as a godly ruler. If it's a democracy, the church's role is to inform the consciences of the demos, the people, in their entirety, so that they collectively can make just and good decisions. So, then you've got varying degrees and mixed, we've got a constitutional republic, so we're not quite a democracy, but we elect our representatives. Once again, the role of the church is to inform the consciences of those people voting, and to inform the consciences of those people that are making the decisions on our behalf in Congress and the presidency and Supreme Court, etc. So the role of the church is to inform the consciences of those who rule. That would be my quick answer.
I think that's acceptable and spot on. I might add, to further illustrate the point back to you, Jim, might be something like, we could look at the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, and one of them, take a straightforward one like stealing. There's a prohibition against stealing. So the church would hold that up as sort of an absolute, right, that there's a prohibition against stealing, backed up by what? The authority of God. God's told us that that is wrong. It's wrong to steal. So how does that impact what goes on, say, in the sphere of the state? Well, it would mean that the state ought to and has the responsibility to enact a code of laws, both civil and criminal, that addresses this prohibition of stealing and how it might actually play out in one's in the societal setting. And then to Mark's point, it's this it's in similar fashion, it's about education, it's about formation. So the Holy Mother Church will hold up principles about what it means to be around human flourishing, what it means to develop into a fully integrated human person. And then when we can use that as sort of the measuring stick as we look at, say, how your any of our, you know, local, say, school systems enact and carry out certain curricula.
Right.
So if there's certain curricula that contravenes or acts against, some of these foundational principles of Holy Mother Church, then we would hold up that as pointing to that curricula as being wrong or incorrect or an error. The same principle apply. We see that in natural law theory as well, where going back to, say, Dr. Martin Luther King's, you know, letter from Birmingham jail, he points out that the way we can tell whether a law is just or unjust is whether or not the law that human beings pass, say, through legislation and enact, the way we know if that's a just or unjust law is whether or not it comports with natural or divine law. So any law that contravenes divine law or natural law, we know is no law at all.
Right.
And that goes to, and he quotes, Martin Luther King is quoting St. Augustine of Hippo on that very point. So there is a way in which, and that kind of goes back to what we're talking about, where the king or queen is not the final arbiter of ultimate right and wrong. It's God who decides that. And so it's connecting all those pieces. So I'm so glad you brought that up. It's the church and the state have this shared responsibility to form and inform, educate the individual in the particular setting in which we find them, and point them towards and orient them towards and habituate them, one of Mark's favorite points.
Right, exactly.
Towards what? Virtue.
Towards virtue. And it's not only one way. It goes the other way too. The church's role is to disseminate the truth, but it is the state's role really to enact the truth, to enact justice, even when it goes back against the church. So, you were talking about the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal. You know, that's one of the principles, and the church rightly teaches, you know, that this is a principle that, you know, justice demands. But if a priest is caught embezzling, it's up to the state to enforce that, kind of regardless of what the church itself teaches.
Well, that's going to bring us to another interesting point, which is, so how does that work? How does that work when you have someone who would seem to be subject to both the authority of the church and to the state? So maybe with that, let's use that as a cliffhanger. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
This is Father John Hollowell, and just wanted to say a word today about the importance of Catholic radio. Last year at one of my parishes, everyone who was in RCIA came to the RCIA classes by listening to Catholic radio. It wasn't anything that our parish had done or anything that I had said as the priest. It was listening to Catholic radio, and I just know that it's the best thing going in terms of bringing the good news of the gospel to the corners of our world and to people who are in need of hearing it. It's so much easier and less threatening for people who have questions and who maybe are kind of looking at Catholicism from the outside. They can listen to radio and have their questions answered. I just feel like it's so important, and I ask you to consider funding Catholic radio here in Indianapolis and in the surrounding area in whatever way God allows you to do that. And just ask you to pray about that, and thank you in advance for helping bring the good news of the gospel to all people through the important apostolate of Catholic radio.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell in the cave with my fellow cave dweller, Mark Tuttle, and Jim Ganley, the big man himself. So great to have you here.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
See, I've been thinking about this. I'm a fellow cave dweller with you, but I don't have a beard to match.
Ooh.
So I need to start growing yeah. that beard so I can be a proper cave dweller.
Yes,
yeah, the club kind of makes up for it.
Yeah.
we ought to think about what would be a suitable Catholic cave uniform.
Exactly. We need a cave uniform.
Like a
exactly.
Fred and Barney, right, from the Flintstones.
Leopard skin, yeah.
Right, with a tie. Well, at the break, we were beginning to we raised a question, really, about what does it mean to be subject to both, say, a canonical authority, church authority, and also temporal authority from the state. So you raised the question, you say, God forbid that a priest were to steal something. You know, what sort of concept, what might be just in a way of addressing,
right, and,
you
and
know,
what,
the wrong that's been committed.
And what worldly authority is he ultimately accountable to? You know, obviously he's accountable to God. So, you know, that kind of goes without saying. You know, we're all accountable to God for our sins. But there are worldly, you know, we are accountable in the here and now. There's temporal punishments, and there's really two spheres to a certain extent there as well. You know, on the one hand we have the law,
and the power of
the state, etc. But then we also have obligations to our families, to our religious congregations, to other associations that are sort of outside of the law to a certain extent, not beyond the law, but just not the state.
Yeah, they're not law enforcement.
Right. Yeah.
Or part of the justice system.
Right, exactly.
Correct.
So there's a difference there. I guess our obligations are characterized slightly differently depending on which side of that coin we're looking at.
Yeah, and it's reasonable to I think it's reasonable to conclude that one might expect in that scenario that there's kind of a couple of there's multiple consequences one might face. So if say clergy were caught shoplifting, they would be subject to the state of Indiana, let's say, laws that govern shoplifting, and they would face those prosecution, and if found guilty, the penalties that go along with that. But also because of their status as clergy, there would be an accountability to their if they belong to a religious community, there'd be an accountability there to the bishop. But then also, as you mentioned, to God, because that this having stolen something, it could, depending what it is in the circumstances, might be venial or mortal sin. So there may also be a need for the sacrament of reconciliation that also brings with it a penance.
Right. And, you know, that's similar to a properly working family mm-hmm. as well. You know, if a son is caught shoplifting, there's legal consequences to that. But then,
there's also going to be something at home.
There ought to be, exactly. And a proper yeah, functioning,
you're going to get grounded, exactly. At least.
Exactly. So, you know, there's consequences within
right.
within the family. And, you know,
that's a great way to think about that relationship that we have with the church is more familial, and with the state, one more of I would say certainly love of country can be a part of that, but also I think one of dutifulness, right, towards the country or nation of which we belong.
Right, and I think that kind of delineates maybe loosely a certain sphere of, you know, where the state is allowed and should intervene, and where you know, really what a father's prerogative would be with his family and disciplining his kids.
Right. I think this might be a good moment to bring up something, you know, that as we were kind of prepping for the show a little bit, we were kind of discussing this, which is that the relationship between church and state over time, depending on, you know, location and things like that, can be very hostile. So, for example, in fact, reading, you know, some of the writings of St. John Paul the Great, you know, the experiences of his own personal experiences as a priest and bishop in Poland under communism was very, very difficult, because the communist puppet masters there in Poland, beholding to their masters there in the Soviet Union, were charged with eradicating the faith in Poland, and that was one of their primary missions. And so that gave, that would give rise. So if the state is actively an atheistic totalitarian state is actively working to destroy the church and destroy your faith and the faith of everyone else with it, that it can reach, we're going to take a very different sort of stance towards it, and one in which we would be very reluctant and extremely cautious in our dealings with that state. And so when things would arise, let's say, within that could be known within the church, the propensity, I think, would be for the church to, again, in that setting, not inform the state, not get entangled with what Reagan called an evil empire, but rather address it on its own.
Right,
so
exactly.
Sort of stay within its own sphere, because the state, and I mean, think of like the Stasi, right? The secret police of the East Germans. I mean, who'd want anything to do with them?
Right, right. And then on the flip side, you know, if you think about this relationship between church and state, similar to a virtue, any virtue is going to have two vices on either extreme. So the virtue is sort of the happy middle ground of this. So if you think of the relationship between church and state in those terms, you've got kind of vices on both sides. So on the one hand, you have the situation in Poland where there's extreme hostility between church and state.
Because the state's vicious.
Right. And then on the other hand, you've got some of the abuses that happened in the Middle Ages where you have too close a relationship. You know, you've got the king who, you know, his third son, you know, he sends to the seminary, and his son then is appointed to be bishop of the local abbey, or I guess the abbot of the local abbey, or even the bishop of a diocese. And so you've got this mixing and mingling between the temporal and spiritual powers to where you really don't find much difference going on.
Yeah, you run the risk in that case of nepotism,
and,
right?
And simony.
Which all were happening.
Exactly.
Yeah, a lot of that going on. So, those are calls for reform, right?
Right. So the happy medium then is a kind of a friendly relationship where the different spheres are pretty well delineated, and there's checks and balances going back and forth.
Right, and there's, you know, so again, going back to sort of the contemporary American setting, for all of its faults, the U.S. government does not operate like a secret police of a communist state at all.
Right, exactly.
And so, and I would say, with some very notable exceptions like legalized abortion, it seems that most of our laws, both civil and federal, while there's plenty of room for prudential judgment, and let's bring up the death penalty as one. We can talk about that a little bit, maybe. That they seem to, the laws generally governing that were governed by here in the United States at the state and local level do seem fair and just in a very general sense, and therefore there's a kind of fosters that compatibility, going back to this notion of, what does it mean to be a faithful citizen and a faithful Catholic? At least in the contemporary American setting, I think there's lots of room for us to be both.
Right, and we have to be vigilant because, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're very blessed that we live in a country where you're right. I mean, with the exception of some unjust laws, abortion, we can talk about capital punishment in a minute. With the exception
I'd say
of
same-sex
some,
marriage is
same-sex
one.
Marriage, exactly. But those are exceptions. By and large, our legal system is very just.
And our laws,
and there's
generally.
Not a lot of interference of the state within right. within the church. You know, there was a call at one point to monitor some of the homilies and some of the
sermons. Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that was in Texas too.
Yeah,
it was
like Houston, Texas. Yeah, and I think what is it, Atlanta, Georgia? Also, there was a similar type of thing. So these things
sounds
pop
crazy.
Up.
Crazy. Yeah,
and we as
but they do
as,
pop up.
They do pop up, and we as Catholic citizens have a duty to try to, I guess, restore that proper balance to where there's not undue interference by the state in the affairs.
And we need
of the
to call
church.
It out and hold our politicians accountable.
Exactly. Okay.
And act against the common good.
So we've teased it up a little bit here. So the one of the big topical issues in the news when it comes to relations between church and state recently is the death penalty. So Pope Francis recently, well, it wasn't Pope Francis directly. It was the
through the CDF,
congregation, exactly, Congregation for the Doctrine and Faith. They changed the paragraph in the Catechism, the Universal Catechism, to
the big green one that everyone has on their bookshelf at home.
Exactly. To more
comes out every weekend for brief reading.
To more or less, I guess, strengthen up what the church's position on the death penalty has been for a little while. And come
revised
out,
it.
Revised yeah. it to, yeah. to come out and say, no, the death penalty is absolutely wrong. You know, there's no, you know, there's
no longer any justification.
There's no longer any justification for it. And we as Catholics, it's part of our duty as Catholics to
abolish it.
To abolish it, exactly. Yeah. So, and this has been met with, I think, applause and, you know, large part of the church, and then some words of approbation from other sides of the church,
right? Or disagreement.
I
would find so where I've put my finger sort of landed on this issue is on the question of, and this is where I think there's clarification needed, is the revision saying that the death penalty is intrinsically evil, and that's why it's absolutely forbidden,
right?
Or is it now because of advancements in technology and et cetera, development of doctrine, that there's no longer any foreseeable justification going forward? From this moment going forward, which are two different things.
Two very different things, and to a certain extent...
And that's where I think there's controversy.
Yeah, and that's where the theologians need to kind of weigh in to see, okay, is the Pope really saying that the death penalty is intrinsically evil? Which that would be a big deal, because that mm-hmm. would be basically saying the Church's stance in the past was wrong. Which
yeah.
You know,
yeah. 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 And consider that there were popes that had, you know, their own executioners.
Right, exactly. So that would be
a big, big deal.
To say it is
that's why I think we need clarity.
And I'll be perfectly honest with you, to a certain extent, you know, you'd be saying that St. Paul was wrong. So
So
that would be a very big deal. But shy of it being intrinsically evil,
First off,
I think one of the things we got to talk about, we got to take a break, is we've got to look at what actually was said and how it was said and where it was said to kind of start to parse through this. So let's take a break, and we can come back and talk a little bit about the role of the Catechism within the Church.
It's not too early to sign up for our Catholic Radio annual dinner. This year's dinner will be on Tuesday, October 2nd at the Northside Knights of Columbus Hall near 71st and Keystone. Archbishop Charles Thompson will be our guest speaker. There'll be a silent auction, a live auction, some great food, and a chance to meet the staff and board members of Catholic Radio Indy. You can sign up right now at CatholicRadioIndy.org or by giving us a call at 317-870-8400.
I know how important the message of hope that you guys give is.
And it could be enough to make a miracle happen in someone else's life like it did for mine.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy thanks you for your support.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, and man, we have covered a huge amount of distance on this this show. So we're talking primarily about the relations between church and state. But before the break, we brought up probably the most topical application of this, and that is the death penalty. The Holy mm-hmm. Father, the Congregation of Doctrine and Faith has recently revised the Universal Catechism and the paragraph in the Catechism talking about the death penalty, and has said that the death penalty is inadmissible. I think that's the English word that was used. I'm not sure what the Italian word would have been, but inadmissible. And so the question with that is, what is this a proclamation of a change of doctrine, or is this a development of doctrine? The CDF in their letter introducing it claimed that this is just merely a development, that this isn't a change in what the church has taught. And so part of that, I think, is we've got to understand what the catechism is, what role the catechism plays within laying out the doctrines and teachings of the church. So the catechism primarily is a summary. It's a summary of what has been taught. So in and of itself doesn't really hold any doctrinal weight. It's a summary of the doctrines that have been promulgated and put forth by the church in other ways.
Right. And something that if you listen to Catholic Radio Indy frequently, as I do, one of my favorite shows is Catholic Answers Live. And one of the best apologists on there is Jimmy Akin. And the reason why I bring this up is Jimmy Akin has been talking about a new book that he has coming out, I think, at the end of this year. And it's on the question that I believe you're raising, Mark, which is really around, dogmatic weight. You know, what weight ought we give different teachings in the church? And because that determines to some extent, among other things, I should say, our responsibility to assent to it or not. So as we're recording, for example, today, it's the Solemnity of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary, Mother of God. And that is a dogma of the church and requires us to assent to the truth of it.
Right.
But not everything. And it's of the highest weight. But in the catechism, one of the shortcomings of the catechism is that that's referenced in the catechism, this solemnity, but and lots of other things that are not of the same weight, but there's no weighting system, so to speak. Right. We need and that's what his new book's going to do, though. His new book coming out, Jamaica's new book, is going to explain and give us a framework by which we'll be able to sort of see. But I think that's part of what we want to understand is what weight, and it's not real easy to see, and different theologians can at times arrive at different conclusions, especially when you move down from the highest category, which is dogma.
Right. You know, we saw this sort of conversation and debate come about when the Pope put out Amoris Laetae, because that was a summary of a council. Mm-hmm. It was not an encyclical.
Right.
And so encyclicals have a higher doctrinal standing than does, an apostolic exhortation,
correct.
I think is what it technically was. So,
And then there's
discussion.
Things that come out of, say, ecumenical councils that are approved by the Pope.
Exactly.
You know, those are considered infallible, believe.
And so
there's all sorts of stuff.
There's all sorts of stuff. And so what the catechism, what catechisms, because there's multiple mm-hmm. catechisms, what they are summaries of these doctrinal statements. But they're not doctrinal statements in and of themselves.
Yeah, good example. So we were talking about the universal one, but maybe to illustrate that point, there's also the UCAT.
Right.
We have the UCAT here, which is the Youth Catechism. And there's actually, I think, if you go to Ignatius Press, there's like five different versions now.
Exactly. A lot of people are familiar with the Baltimore Catechism.
Correct.
Once again, it's not that the Baltimore Catechism was like somehow replaced by the Universal Catechism.
No. The
formulation is a different way of summarizing
updating.
the content of the teachings of the
Church. The UCAT's very hip.
Right.
If you have with lots of color pictures.
Right. So when the CDF changed the language, what they were saying is this is a better summary of what the church has taught regarding
and now holds.
And so they went back to some of the teachings of John Paul II. Mm-hmm. They went back to some of the
statements. And he almost closed the door completely.
He almost did.
He left it open just a little bit. The word inadmissible seems to be to close it completely.
Right. Well, to a certain extent, though, the question would be, is that inadmissibility, is that temporally contained? And the letter from the CDF seemed to indicate that, yes, it was. In other words, there were times in the past when the death penalty was admissible. Now it is inadmissible. It leaves the door open for perhaps in the future we may come to a point in time again where it needs to be admissible as well. So
that's why we need the clarification on whether or not it's an intrinsic evil.
Right.
Because if it's intrinsic evil, that's not subject to change.
Right.
If inadmissible is rather more pointing towards the application of the death penalty in the contemporary setting, that there's no longer any justification for its application, that's a different matter altogether.
And inadmissibility also may be a form of development And once again, the letter from the CDF basically indicates
it could be.
This is a development of our understanding of the dignity of the human being. That the dignity of the human being is such. And like I said, the discussion around, we were talking about this over the break, Tim, the discussion around the death penalty is very parallel in a lot of ways, gels with the discussion around the use of torture. That, you know, there has been a development within the church of the understanding of the dignity of the human being that has moved us towards a situation where torture is completely inadmissible, where that understanding in the past wasn't there. And so it's a development of the understanding of the dignity of the human being that has led the church to realize that these practices are inadmissible.
Yeah, I wonder how it fits in. What's not talked much about in the death penalty these days, but certainly has been raised by theologians in the past, is this the death being placed on, say, death row. So having received a conviction such and then a punishment such that the person is found is going to be executed, that had been held as a catalyst for conversion. So in other words, when faced with one's imminent death, it can bring about a certain clarity of mind. And you can see that illustrated. There aren't a lot of death row movies out there, but there is the one with Sean Penn called Dead Man Walking.
Right.
And it's based on a true story. And it's going to drive me nuts, but I can't remember the nun who she's still alive. Sister Prejean, maybe?
Yeah, Sister Helen Prejean.
Who's done, you know, all this prison ministry, especially around, and especially, you know, trying to bring about an end to the death penalty. But you see in that film, Sean Penn's character, a murderer, a rapist, he is holding out to the lie of his innocence up until the last moments, and it's only when he's confronted with just being minutes away from his own execution that he does repent. That had been held as a justification for one of the justifications for the death penalty, that it can bring about repentance in a way that the removal of the death penalty does not.
Right, right. And you know, the flip side of that as well, that you see one of the arguments against the death penalty is that it takes away the eventual chance for repentance if that repentance doesn't happen. So,
right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if they die unrepentant,
right,
that's
exactly.
It.
And that's been cited. Right. I think that might even be a part of the language of the catechism, is that, you know, by executing a prisoner, you've now removed the chance for repentance.
I think too, yes. Yeah, that's true. That can be true as well. Here's why we have, I think, that why the prudential decision, you know, judgments can differ. Though the other one I'll bring up, because I know we're going to run out of time here on the cave, is the idea of having the state having the authority to execute its own citizens, I think, is one that's, to me, I find one of the more convincing reasons not to have the death penalty. That if you look across, as I look across, say, even the 20th century, you have far more people being executed by their own government than you do if you were to total up all the people killed during warfare in the 20th century. It's somewhere about 120 million people. But if you add up all the people that were killed by their own governments,
right,
i.e. the Soviet Union, Khmer Rouge, Mao's communist China, you have 300 to 400 million people being killed by their own government. It's far more dangerous than warfare.
Right. And
in
most
that
of,
sense.
And most of.
So why give them the power to kill?
And most of those that were executed obviously unjustly. So, you know, the
oh, yeah, because you get in the way of the project of the state. That's
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Without trial, without, you know,
show trial sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, those were unjust executions. So, yeah, you really could make the argument that the majority of executions are, you know, just blatantly unjust like that.
Well, you know what? We are just about out of time, Mark. Boy, this has been a fun show. I mean, very interesting.
We'll have to come back and revisit some of these topics that we've
been talking about. Yeah. These are things that also change over time and our setting. There's a lot going on in the news. But thank you all for tuning in to the Catholic Cave. Again, I'm Timothy O'Donnell with our fellow cave dweller, Mark Tuttle, and special guest star, we heard him a little bit earlier, Jim Ganley, apprentice to the cave.
Oh. The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to Kent@CatholicRadioIndy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.